Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank, and I am the host of this show. Joining me this evening is Donna Smith, a tireless grassroots community organizer for single-payer health delivery. Donna and her family were documentary film subjects in Michael Moore's Sicko, a movie which was largely suppressed in this country by the health insurance industry. For those of you who have not seen it, it is possible to see it free online. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Donna Smith. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you tonight?
I am doing very well.
Great. It's great to hear your voice. I'm so happy that you're here.
Oh, I am too. It's wonderful to be on the show.
Thank you. So in trying to figure out exactly how to approach this subject, I mean, I think that probably everybody knows, or maybe they don't know, about your experience with Sicko and how you were chosen. But more importantly, I think that's always an interesting topic, but we need to probably segue into how we are doing with single-payer here in this country and how possible it is to get this to happen. But my main question, my first question would be, were you always in the single-payer, or was the whole experience with your health care just inability to get any kind of coverage for your, you know, the stuff that was going on with your family, is that what it all... You got interested in it then, or were you always interested?
Well, I don't think I was. Oh, that's a good question, and great to move on from what we all saw in Sicko. But I don't think I was always interested in healthcare. But I think from the point in my adult life where I saw it really doing, saw what this healthcare system, the damage that it's really doing to people in my own family and people I loved and cared about in my own community, whether it was with my husband and myself or with others in the family, once I started to see those problems, which was really pretty early in my adult life, I thought there had to be a better way. So I don't think I framed it as being, in my own mind, an interest in single payer until I got a little bit more knowledgeable later on. But I would say as early as the early 1980s, I already had made some decisions about what I felt was right and wrong in terms of health care.
Yeah. And I think for Tom, my husband and I, we were interested knowing that it was a totally inequitable system, but that the fact that Jerry Brown was running for president on single payer back in 1993 was we got involved in his campaign, and that was pretty exciting. We went to the Democratic National Convention in New York City, and where the press systematically kind of made Jerry Brown look like an idiot. But what else is new?
Yeah, true. Very true. I think one of my first recollections, if I go all the way back into my young adulthood, just finding it a little bit, not a little bit, but very difficult to understand that when you had a child, and this was in my real youth when I look back now, when you have a child, that the stop you make on the way out of the hospital is at the business office with this beautiful young life in your arms to make sure that you've paid the rest of your bill following your insurance on the way. I thought there's something a little bit strange about this. that you can't, no one would ever say you can't leave the hospital with your baby if you haven't paid the bill. But I thought, how weird is this that we have to stop and take care of this before we depart with this little one? And later on, then, and my husband's grandmother, who I adored so very much, Grandma Elsie, we all called her, and the fact that she had to become impoverished before she could get the nursing care that she needed late in her life, and watching how some wealthier families sometimes basically divested themselves of things so that older family members could receive the care they need. I thought, how can this be just? And those things were well before my own life education and what happened. And how can you as an American not watch those things transpire around you and not think, this is so wrong? One of our nurse leaders, I love when she says we're basically one of the only countries on the planet that barters human life for money. It's just wrong.
Yeah, I think it's pretty amazing too that people don't seem to even question, even now. A lot of, I don't mean the people that are in the grassroots movements that we know. But the people who are involved in single payer, or the people who are involved in Occupy Wall Street, Occupy, you know, whatever city that they're occupying, et cetera. But I mean, the people I work with and the people who are involved in healthcare, my nursing friends are really largely ignorant of this problem. And I think, I'm not sure why. And I think they kind of want to stay that way. They seem to think that I'm some sort of novelty, and because I will talk about it all the time, you know.
Of course.
You have to.
Of course,
to.
I know you must. You know, you have to is right. You know, and I share that with you. I watch sometimes people who aren't obviously political in what they're doing in the world, and who are being harmed very greatly by the system being set up the way it is, and yet they're oblivious that there might be another way, or worse still, sometimes they're agitated that people, you know, they'll argue in their own worst interests. And you think, in the world can you stand there knowing that you couldn't get medication for your own child, or that your neighbor, I had a neighbor early on who had cancer, a mother of four, and who basically allowed herself to withdraw from treatment earlier than she probably should have because she didn't want to harm her family's financial standing any further going forward. And I thought, how could other neighbors in our group, because there were a group of us in the neighborhood who knew about it, how could people watch that transpire and not see that as great trauma within our human families and within our communities happening, and argue that we have the best healthcare system in the world, which many people will say, but we still have the best healthcare system in the world. And you say, you know, not only are people not informed, they're actively arguing against their own interests, which is hard, so hard to understand.
Well, I think that the fact is that many people did not see sicko, and that was because it was suppressed. Censorship, etc., as Wendell Potter had outlined in his book Deadly Spin, that the movie was about to go into every major movie theater in the United States, but then it was suppressed. So I think that when people see that movie, they change their minds. They suddenly understand something, their provincial worldview suddenly expands to understand that there's something else that could happen here.
Yeah, and I tell audiences all the time, I was just in California last week on a bus tour where we were talking a little bit with James Haslam of the Vermont Workers Center. He and I were out there helping launch the Campaign for a Healthy California there, and one of the things I was telling people was, look, Michael Moore is a filmmaker. And, you know, he didn't choose my husband and I's story of being an insured couple that ended up going bankrupt and losing everything we had because we were unique in a our system. He chose it because we weren't unique, and because it would represent the largest numbers of people in our society and what people are faced with and struggling with, in spite of playing by whatever those, you know, I have people always tell me, don't say that there are rules in our society. But there are kind of unspoken rules we have in our society about how we're all supposed to do things and what it means to do the right things. And, you know, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. And you're right. A lot of people who should have seen Sicko and thought about it more deeply about could I walk in those shoes some days, whether it was mine or one of the people who lost a family member due to the corruption and greed in the system. Could that be my family? Could that be my child or my spouse? Those things kind of do shake you loose and make you start to think a little differently about things. I want to share something with you before I forget it today. My husband told me that he was watching a program on CNN, God forbid. I'm always telling him to stop watching that. In any case, he was watching, they were reporting they had an embedded CNN reporter in the Occupy Wall Street in Zuccotti Park. And they said that they one of the first camera pans was on a young man sitting down reading a copy of the Communist Manifesto.
Good.
And I thought, okay, you know, for you and I, we're like, great, we should see that. But CNN is playing its own very important role, just like Wendell Potter told us the insurance industry played its role in suppressing Sicko. CNN is playing its media, mainstream media role in trying to make it look to the widest audience possible like the Occupy movement is all about those evil communists coming over the hill to get us all.
Yeah, now can you believe that this is still going on? But it is. The threat of communism is so ridiculously embedded. There's the word embedded in our history, the American history, that usually we are now hearing the word terrorism as a replacement for the word communism.
Absolutely.
But now to actually bring that fear of communism again with that picture, well, you know, it's probably a good idea for you guys, for Larry, to be watching CNN to see what the stuff that they're doing. That's pathetic.
Exactly. And, you know, you're right. It is good because he'll call me and he'll say, you'll never guess what I saw. And it is good for me to know what's going on out there in the media and what kinds of things they're saying about whether it's health care or whether it's the movement for people to raise their rights and their speech. We need to know what the opposition is painting for us.
Yes. And I think it all does come down to compassion. When a person has lost their, or even if they have insurance nowadays and they have a life-threatening illness and their insurance doesn't pay for it, when that happens to them, suddenly their hearts open and they actually do have compassion for other people. Or in the situation with people losing their homes and people not having jobs, all the kids coming out of college and not having any work, what happens when this personally affects a human being is that their hearts open and they suddenly see with compassion and kindness. What is so sad is that the people who are not affected by these things don't seem to think that it has anything to do with them. So I had actually gone down to our own Occupy encampment here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Now, you would be very impressed by this particular group of people. They are, well, first of all, our mayor is responsible for the greatness of it because I came to realizing that for so long I keep saying, well, there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. But I came to realize that there is a difference because if we had the encampment up there with the Republican mayor, he would be, or she would not tolerate them to be there. But our mayor has made it. Given them the space next to the police station so they feel protected. And he is really tremendous. And we can thank him first and foremost. And then you have to thank the kids for sticking through the snowstorm the other day. And,
absolutely.
And just, they're just really, we have community sit-ins there. It's very peaceful. They have a lot of food. They're getting money. But one day I went down and put my new video camera on my iPhone, which is just perfect. It's a beautiful, beautiful camera. And I found this man who was willing to talk to me, and he is a homeless man, and he came over to the Occupy encampment, first of all, because he needed a place to live, and he was terrified of being arrested every night, so now he doesn't have that terror. And secondly, he found this beautiful community, he found his family, and everybody's sharing, everybody is having a common vision about how the world can be changed. And he went on and on. It's a great video. And it got me thinking how, well, just the whole concept of us taking care of each other, as we had thought about discussing here tonight, and starting with a homeless man having this compassionate attitude. And then when I put the YouTube video up, then people were saying, I got these comments like, get a job and stuff like that.
Yeah, I know.
I just wonder if compassion is something that people don't know about. Is that something, is that something they don't want to experience or don't want to open their hearts? Because once you do experience it, then you really can't go back.
No, you really can't. And I always am very thankful that my parents raised me with a healthy dose of, even though they were very Republican, but they were, I always tell folks, they were a brand of Republican we would scarcely recognize today.
Exactly.
And, you know, they raised me to be compassionate and to understand that the circumstances into which I was born, even though we were not wealthy by any stretch, were I was so privileged in comparison to most of the rest of the people on the face of the planet. And that as a consequence, you know, that it was important that I give back in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned early that felt right. And I felt, and not only did it feel right, it just felt good. And it feels, I know I've probably shared with more people than I should, but the moments in my life when I'm least proud of my behavior, and I'm by no means perfect in this regard, are those moments when I turn away from somebody who needs help, or when I turn, and I do it sometimes too still, and I'm ashamed when I do.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the moments when I'm least human, when I'm least fully human, and I don't like that.
And then turning away from the conservative element, which are, you know, I think we all tend to turn away from the rabidly right-wing fanatical stuff, and they turn away from us. So you have to wonder how you can bridge that gap to have them understand that what we're talking about is not communism, although it might be socialism, but it's who cares, you know? Who cares? And I actually asked the homeless man what he thought of the right wing calling what he was talking about socialism. He said, well, if socialism is community, then I'm all for it. I thought that was a great answer.
Yeah, absolutely. What could be wrong with that? I always wonder, you know, I guess I like it when Michael Moore will talk about it being civilized medicine. If you want to talk about socialized medicine, maybe if people have some objection to that, we should call it civilized medicine.
Where
we just care for each other, where we know that it's the right thing to do, and it's not antithetical to making money. I'm not against folks making money. And, you know, it's just, if we have bought all of this brainwashing for so long about what it means to make money and to be successful in our country, and at some level you have to come back home to yourself somehow.
Yes. There's just too much thinking and too much arguing going on. I mean, really, at the heart of it all, we're all here on this planet, and I can't imagine why there's so much dissension and so much, there's so much war, so many wars, so much suffering. That is just an amazing phenomenon, because when you look at Earth from out in space, you know, the astronauts have actually had a kind of a spiritual religious experience where suddenly they realize that we are on that planet, and it's the most beautiful thing they've ever seen. And why is there so much torment, so much suffering, so much angst? It's really quite an interesting thing to think about.
It's so true. And how often have you or I had that experience when we're in nature, when we look at something beautiful in nature, or if you find a cityscape beautiful, which I can at times too, and you look and you think, how can that not be shared by all of us?
Yeah,
I had this experience right after the Iraq. I can't remember. It was probably this time around in the Iraqi War, and I was watching a news program early on when the war had just started, and they showed U.S. soldiers who had gone to a home and had the family come out. They were afraid there were some terrorists in there or some military people that meant harm inside the family's home. And that family was out on the lawn, on their knees, with the guns, well, our soldier pointed at them. And it broke my heart on so many levels.
Yes.
Because I thought just not only of the family kneeling, obviously, and the children shaking and frightened and wanted their parents, but what that was doing to the souls and the hearts of those soldiers pointing those guns at those children and that family. And I thought, what would any of us think that wouldn't be so horrifying in our own communities, in our own, what would that feel like if somebody burst in your front door tonight and did that?
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, people in this country to have that happen, if, for instance, as an example, if a person has a cure for cancer, which there have been people in this country who have, and the FDA goes storming in and breaks everything and steals everything and steals all the records, that is just one example of how this stuff does happen here.
Absolutely.
In the case of domestic quote, domestic terrorists who are being, I'd say, brutalized every day here in this country. And but one of my heroes in this whole thing is Amy Goodman. I'm sure you watch her.
Absolutely.
I am just so impressed by her, how she handles herself. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, she is pretty amazing. And Kate, I know probably you're thinking, oh, Donna's going all over the place in our discussion, but this is one of the fun things about talking with you, because I know it's okay to do that. But I was thinking about a friend of mine, I was thinking about riding the train because, I was listening to Amy Goodman the other day on the train and so forth. And a friend I met on the train, I know you'll appreciate this story because I know you're going to know it's true, was part of a team of researchers in the early 1990s studying the impact of fish oil on brain health. The way they came to those studies was because there had been noticed in a population in Asia, people had less of depression who ate high levels of fish with the right kinds of fish oil and omega-3s in them.
Mm-hmm.
So this was known pretty early on in the 1990s that omega-3s from fish oil were a very healthy thing for the brain, and we knew that in this country. And very early on, the government came to this person and this fellow researcher and said, you're not going to publish that study. And they squelched the publication of that study.
Right.
And
now it's common knowledge.
20 years later, what do we all hear about and read about and know now to be the case? That omega-3s are good for the human body and good for brain health and good for artery health. And some of these things were known a long time ago, but they weren't in the best interest of the pharmaceuticals and of the moneyed interest to get them out there. So we have truth tellers within our communities and within our media, like Amy Goodman and like others. We need to celebrate them, encircle them with all the positive energy we possibly can, and get the word out to one another. Because imagine what we would have averted in terms of human suffering, even with omega-3 knowledge 20 years ago.
Absolutely. It's so true. Well, I think we have to remember that dissent is at the heart of a democracy. And I was reminded about this again. Here we are going all over the place. But I just read the book called My Song by Harry Belafonte. It's called My Song, a memoir by Harry Belafonte, in which he really outlines the civil rights movement, of which he was very, very much a part. and he was like a confidant for Martin Luther King. I don't know if you heard of the book or anything.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't read it yet, though.
Yeah, I highly, highly recommend it because, I mean, he talks about his life pretty much solely in terms of the civil rights movement and his experience in the Jim Crow South and also his experience just being having a lot of prejudice against him because of the color of his skin. So in this book, he discusses how the civil rights movement really took off when the young people really got involved. Not to say that it was a pretty picture, but it did help with changing the whole country. Not that we don't have a long way to go still, but you know what I'm saying. So he, and that's what the Occupy movement is reminding me of. I mean, for so long, we all have been involved in grassroots efforts, but the young people really have not been visible. But now that they are, there's a whole new feel to what's going on. And even though this CNN would like to capture somebody reading the Communist Manifesto, I think that's old stuff. I mean, really, what we have is that dissent is at the root of democracy, and the more we question and the more we want to change this country for the good, I think we are in line with the founding fathers. Instead of, which is what I have often, you know, just start grumbling about the fascist country and stuff like that, I would rather look at this country as a democracy, and I would rather look at it as something that I can be a part of instead of being separated or feeling alienated from.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's hard for, you know, and I'm glad that they're putting the energy out there, the young folks, and some of them, it's hard for them to see this country as a democracy right at the moment. It's hard for people to see it that way because
yeah.
We have moved so far into a different realm. But I tell folks that maybe what we've seen is that either the democracy unfortunately shifted into corporate interests, and so that's why I think the Occupy Wall Street movement is so perfectly seated right there in New York. I think that's the brilliant place for it to be. So often people want to hold time and space enough for this. A whole
yeah.
million person marches in Washington, D.C., and, you know, they think that they're going to compel, you know, Congress or the president or an individual to make something different or change it. But I think this is a wonderful movement. Talking with some of my contemporaries last week in California, and we're so glad that young people are rising up the way they are doing now. And they have to. It's their future that's coming. You know, our generation is now, maybe will be, some of us will have a little bit of elder wisdom to offer, not as much as I had hoped I might by this time, but maybe we'll have just enough to pass on so that they can carry this movement forward and return us to some of the democratic ideals that are the better ones.
Yes, well, I was at Occupy Wall Street, and something you said about the young people not really seeing this as a democracy. First of all, these people I was talking to, they're young men, were telling me that they were very, very let down by our president. They were the type of kids who were out there on the streets getting the votes out for him in 2008. And I had noticed firsthand from their telling me that they feel betrayed by Obama. So it's going to be impossible for him to get that energy that he had because he really hasn't stood by what he said he was going to do, I would say. Finally.
Yeah, and what a terrible amount of political capital to squander. My gosh, I mean, this amazing lift he had from these young people out there working for him and working with their hearts and souls and passion like we haven't seen in the political environment in many, many years and maybe in our lifetimes. And so, you know, this incredible capital that he came into his office with, political lift from the American people, and then to turn around and compromise it away, I think that
wow.
I don't know where the advice he was getting was coming from necessarily. We know where some of it was coming from. But
the banks.
Goldman Sachs.
You have to look at it and wonder. You know, folks had said very clearly they wanted a significant change in this country from where, the direction we were going. And, you know, here the economy was falling apart and so many people were desperately in trouble and hurting. And yet in the midst of even all of that, because the bailout came before the election, the first big bailout of the banks came before the elections. So, you know, people already knew the coming difficulties were coming.
That's
so,
right.
You know, they still went out and voted in these huge record numbers and entrusted to this, wrong to entrust perhaps to one person all your hopes and all your dreams. But that wasn't all of it. We had a Democratic Congress, Democratic Senate and House. So there was an enormous amount they could have gotten done in that couple of years that might not have seen the turn of events we've seen. So it's hard for young people now to not feel betrayed. How would you not feel betrayed when somebody...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Do it.
Oh, I felt their pain, believe me, because I think we're all feeling that kind of betrayal. And we can't help it. I mean, you can't really help it. And it's hard to just say, well, so many people say, well, Obama's just waiting for his second term and then he'll turn everything around. But why? Where's the evidence?
Yeah, I don't believe that. You're a nurse. Do you believe that?
No, that's not. There is no evidence to suggest that that could possibly happen. So I think that I wanted to ask you, too. Now, given all of these variables that we've been discussing, I wanted to ask you, how do you think, and I'm going to be positive, very positive here, how do you think single payer will actually happen in this country? Because it's going to, right?
Well, I believe it's going to, too. And I think the path, after traveling California with James from the Vermont Worker Center, I guess I have to feel pretty confident about the ability of, first of all, of young people to engage in this issue, because they certainly are and have. And we saw spoke to a heavy mix of people who are very new to the discussion and a younger mix, which is indicative of both crisis and opportunity, I think. But
right.
I personally think, because I watch that we have a wonderful number of that are very energetic in the single-payer effort and movement in this country, I believe that the path is going to be through one or more states moving forward on single-payer and consequence of that movement on the state level, that it won't probably take too long after that for national single-payer plan to come forward. Now, having said that, I also point people to the reality that we were just talking about Barack Obama and his incredible win in 2008. And if you were to ask people in early 2008, in a contest between Barack Obama and McCain, if you polled everyone in this country about who would win, Barack Obama would win Illinois. Period.
Mm-hmm.
That was the reality. And in a very short amount of time, in fact, a rapid turnaround, those figures turned around so much so that Barack Obama won in a resounding victory. So things can change and change quickly on the political environment in the United States. And that on the national level, so the dynamic even of these Occupy Wall Street movements that we're seeing spring up all over the country, I don't think any of us knows for sure where that energy is going to take us politically and how far it can take us politically. It's exciting and it's marvelous, and when the change rolls through the country, and I always say I've been in insistent waves of justice, as it must in this country, it will come in ways we don't even expect right now. So it could very well be that I'll end up wrong. It will happen on a national level. Right now, if I had an educated guess, I would say a few states tipping us over into that pool.
Well, given the fact that the Obama's healthcare initiative, given that whole scenario, it's just not adequate. So I would then say, yeah, it's going to have to go state by state.
Yeah, I imagine, though. I mean, I know your heart must break for this, too, to think about how much suffering is yet to come because of not having what we need to have in the health care.
Well, I think that the majority of burnout, and we have a huge burnout in our profession of doctors and nurses and so forth, and I think a lot of that can be attributed to our healthcare system. You know, and I do believe we have a great healthcare system. That's not the problem. The problem, not with good healthcare, period, but the problem is access. So if you don't have access to the system, what good is it? It's not any good. It's ridiculous. So
absolutely.
I
don't know. I'm sure you probably have followed this, but I've been talking with folks about the fact that when sicko first came out, the number we were all using about the people who die in this country every year because they can't access health care, not because the care isn't there, but because they can't afford to access it, don't have coverage and don't have cash, was about 18,000 a year. Within
wow.
a short amount of time after sicko came out, that number was revised upwards after studies by PNHP, Physicians for a National Health Program, and others did great work and revised that number up to 45,000 people annually dying without access to health care in the United States. Just a few weeks ago, another study came out, and the Commonwealth Fund, which none of us would mistake for being a lefty, liberal, or fair supportive organization, came out with new figures yet again. And that number now stands at 100,000 people die every year, unnecessary deaths, United States, due to a lack of access. Think about
that.
That
is unbelievable.
100,000 people a year.
Because they die from lack of access.
That's a horrible number of deaths.
Oh, my gosh, it is. He said 18,000?
When sicko first came out in 2007, and then that was revised upwards to 45,000 a year within a short amount of time, and now that's revised even upwards further to 100,000. It's just staggering stuff.
Oh, my God, I cannot believe it. So this is just tragic, really.
It is tragic, and, you know, it's something that I think what we're seeing reflected at Occupy Wall Street, and obviously they're talking about a very broad agenda of things that, you know, and none of us are fooled by the mainstream media saying that there's confusion about what exactly Occupy Wall Street want. That's not true.
Yeah.
There's a lot that Occupy Wall Streeters want. One of those things is justice in the healthcare system and equality. Nothing about providing access to labor to healthcare that diminishes. In fact, it lifts me, and it lifts community, and it lifts jobs, and it lifts everything if we have access to healthcare. And so that's well understood by the Occupy Wall Street movement. The people who pretend they don't understand are the one whose interest it is. The way it is.
Well, I think that story may have changed. I'm not sure, a little bit. People had said that in the beginning, that they don't really know what they're doing or they don't know what they stand for, blah, blah, blah. But it seems to me that their message has become more widely spread. And you know, it's just tragic to see the policemen in Oakland and in New York do what they have done to these kids. And that's largely censored in our mainstream media.
Yes, and
but
why not so much smarter to do what your mayor's doing? Now, it sounds like your mayor in Lancaster is doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah, I think maybe. Yeah, I think we ought to get the word out on that. Yeah.
Yeah, to be kind to people, let them protest.
What do you think? The Oakland police, I have absolutely, I can't fathom the violence that they put those people through and probably still are. And the New York people, the New York police, New York and NYPD are still sneaking around doing their stuff. I'm floored by this. Yeah, so I think that our mayor and our movement here should be held up as a beautiful example of what it could be, that we value dissent in our society because it is at the heart of a true democracy.
I know. I was so excited to hear you say that about Lancaster. It makes me feel really good. I mean, I already love Lancaster anyway, but it made me love it more when I heard that. I thought, now, how wonderful is that to have a mayor that's supportive of people being safe while they're demonstrating and having a place to do it? And, you know, largely, if we all think about it, the violence, I mean, the pictures I've seen are just horrific of the – one of the best stories, I think, people – you know, if, I don't know how folks feel about NPR, but I listened to an NPR youth radio report. If you can get a hold of this report from youth radio about the Oakland police, just listening to the sound in the background of what was unfolding there – is just it's chilling to listen to that and to think we listen and think that our young people doing nothing more than protesting, and this young man Scott Olson, who was so horribly wounded. I mean, this was a young Iraq war vet who was standing there peacefully next to a guy in his Navy uniform, and boom, this happens to him. And then other people shot with rubber bullets who were doing nothing. Just
actually
nothing.
Rushing in to help him, you know. And
I know.
Shot up.
It's just you. Anybody who hasn't listened to that report, the youth radio report on Scott Olson, it's just breathtaking. It was done by a young person doing the reporting, and it's just a really, it's a good illustration of, first of all, quality reporting, but also gives us a picture of some of the less kind things people still do to people in our society, and why it's important for those of us who aren't so young to help stand with these young people as they try and get this movement to make real change in our country.
Yeah, it's also a great testament, too, of how everybody is a journalist. Everybody can take pictures of what's going on, and the fact that so much was captured on film, and then the New York City kind of, when all the 700 people, a mass arrest on the Brooklyn Bridge that day, and I don't know if you saw pictures of Times Square. There's this is a great story. I must tell you the story. You probably already saw it on Amy Goodman, but she kind of downplayed it. But you know, I like to look at the way animals act. The my beautiful example of that would be the elephants picking up German tourists and saving them from the tsunami back in the year, you know, back in the year 2000 or something. Not the Japanese tsunami, but the one before that. So now the NYPD was trying to get, rearing their horses up on their hind legs to go at the protesters on Times Square on the 15th of October. People were terrified. And then the horses went down on their knees and refused to get up.
I did see. I was just, you know, you and I share a love of animals. Animals are often kind, but we're not as human beings. And they know. I think animals know, you know, not every, you know, animals can be wild too. But
animals are,
you know, they have a compassion and a sense about things that we don't understand fully sometimes. But it's pretty amazing to watch it when they demonstrate something that we don't demonstrate for each other. You know, maybe an animal knows when, why would I want to stomp this person? They're not doing anything.
Yeah, the horses, obviously the horses in New York City are very, very tame. They've come to love people, and they know that the people are they're highly intelligent creatures.
Of course.
So, and then after these horses went down on their knees, then the very, very head of the NYPD came out, and the policeman thought that he was going to support them. He told them to get out of the area, you know, get out. And then the people were screaming or yelling in great jubilation, you know, you are one of the 99% kind of thing, because he saved the day. But who really saved the day? It was those horses. It was so cool.
Yeah, of course. You know, some of these scenes, and I don't know, I've been watching with some interest because when I was a young girl, I lived in Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago. And during the times of the rioting in Chicago surrounding the 1968 Democratic Convention and some of the anti-war protesting that was going on at the time and some of the civil rights protests, I used to, as a young girl, just sit and cry and hold my side because I could not believe that human beings would hit other human beings over the head with billy clubs or that they would use fire hoses on people in the street.
Oh, I know. That was awful.
I could not tolerate as a young girl watching those things. It used to make me physically ill. And some of this stuff I watch, it reignites some of that feeling of outrage, of sadness, and about, oh, my God, you know, but I'm not a young girl anymore. I'm a grown woman who can stand up and say, stop. You can't, you shouldn't do that to my fellow
right.
citizens. I wouldn't do it to, even if one of my fellow citizens was certainly and maybe especially saying something I didn't agree with. It's still their right to say it and still their right to dissent in this country. And to and at least that's one of the things I have valued the most. And so, you know, some of that is pulling on some real old tapes for me and ones that I hope I can use to draw on in a better way now that I'm an adult and have a way to react a little differently.
Yeah, and I think certain spiritual practices help us to detach lovingly so that we're not so emotionally crippled sometimes by this stuff. I mean, and then, of course, you know, even going to a psychologist or a I wouldn't go to a psychiatrist because of all the meds they, I don't believe in all these medicines that are being prescribed. But, you know, I just think all the help we can get to look at all of this as compassionately, even the people who are on the other side, so-called other side, like the Sarah Palins or the Michelle Bachmans who don't seem to have or the whole, let's put it this way, the whole Republican, all those Republicans who are running for office are absolutely insane. But
gosh, where do they find? You know, I know that there are some very decent people who still are in the Republican ranks, but I'm like,
yes.
Where did you find this crop of folks to run for president?
I know, really? I mean, what do you really want to win? But I
so true. Every time Herman Cain starts singing again, I think, why are you singing? This is surely a sign that things aren't going well for you.
my point of even bringing them up is I just feel like I need to have a little bit more, just instead of ranting and raving, and I have, which I've been known to do, by the way, you know, it's in the, as you had said earlier, something about becoming more human, and even those people, if they really needed help, I would like to think that I would help them. And also, one time, I posed a thing on my blog. There was a terrorist, a so-called terrorist, who had been injured and was taken to a New York hospital. And I posed the question out there that really seemed to upset healthcare people, that if he were in my care, I would take care of him like he was my father, or like he was my brother. And people were very upset by that. But I think that is what we take an oath like that when we're nurses or doctors. And so many times people forget that.
Absolutely. You know, that made me think about the recent push in Arizona where they wanted healthcare professionals to, before they would treat someone in the emergency room, make sure they checked their documents to make sure they
were... Oh, that's horrible. That is horrible.
And every nurse and doctor I knew, now I'm sure not every nurse and doctor in Arizona, but every nurse and doctor I spoke to said, you can't possibly want us to check to make sure someone is a citizen before we treat them in the emergency room. That can't be what we do in this country. It can't be
that's
what
right.
we do anywhere. You don't check someone's citizenship when they're bleeding or they're having a heart attack.
That is laughable, but it is sad because they really were serious about that.
Yes, they were. And you think, oh, my God, you can't come on. What if you next week happen to forget your driver's license or forget something to bring it along with you? Do you want to count on the fact that that person looking at you is going to assume that you're an American citizen? What if you're incapacitated, can't speak and prove that you're someone of the native tongue, so to speak? What's going to happen to you then? And the Native Americans made a good point. None of you have the right documentation, according to us.
That's good. That's really good.
Which I thought was great. It's fun. Yep, you're right. We don't.
And they don't want it.
No,
because all the land is free.
Exactly.
Yes. I was thinking that one way that President Obama could vindicate himself is to say no to the Tarzan coming down from Canada. And all this fracking. I think he needs to take a stand against certain very important issues that are paramount for the health of our earth.
Oh, isn't that true? So true. I know I've mentioned it a couple of times on the call because I so enjoyed traveling with James Haslam from the Vermont Worker Center, but he's a young man with a wife and one child, another one on the way, and he was talking about the health of the planet and how much he worries for his young children about what we're leaving them and their ability to even survive on the planet if we don't get it under control of what's going on in our generation. You know, I know you remember, too, we were the ones who were going to be so environmentally conscious and so worried about that, and yet, oh my gosh, what a mess. And you're so right. There are some steps that could be taken right now to change some of the trending there.
Yes, it seems like our generation went to sleep, and I hope that doesn't happen here.
Well, it can't. The planet won't survive.
Well, you know, when the head of NASA, the head scientist at NASA said that the tar sands would be the end game for Earth. Well, what greater authority do you need to believe something that really needs to be changed? And he went to jail, you know. He was one of the people that were arrested during the Tarzan's thing that was going on in Washington. I don't understand why. Now, of course, at a recent talk that President Obama was giving, there was somebody in the audience screaming about the Tarzans, which is great. And he actually did say stop and say, well, we're looking at that right now. But he needs to say, the buck stops with him. It doesn't have anything to do with the State Department. It doesn't have anything to do with Congress, and it doesn't have anything to do with anybody else in Washington. He is the one who needs to say no. And he would be greatly respected if he did. If he doesn't say no, I would say I can't imagine he would be reelected.
Yeah, I mean, imagine how powerful it would be if he would take that kind of a stand, you know, on that issue and on for the planet's concern to say, you know, this is a planet that's for all of us. It's not anyone, certainly not one political party or one nation that benefits or doesn't from this. It's all of us in it together, and it's something we have to protect. He's got children. He has daughters who I know he loves very deeply. And
that's right.
About. He doesn't want to leave a mess to them either.
No, it'd be great if his daughters would tell him a few things, which
maybe
they probably do. I think they do. I think they do. So you were mentioning Vermont as one of the states that could go single payer, but I think they are poised before all the other ones to do so. But Pennsylvania is another one that, as you know, Chuck Pinocchio and Jerry Polakoff and all the others in the group in the single payer initiative here in Pennsylvania are really working hard, and they're always on calls, and they're just amazing. They truly believe that single payer is going to happen here in Pennsylvania, even with our governor Corbett is not exactly friendly towards the idea, but could be that he won't be in office forever. I would think.
Well, and I have to tell you, every time I speak anywhere in the country, I talk about the incredible example Pennsylvania sets for the rest of the country, and that you have had Republican and Democratic co-sponsors on your single-payer legislation. And that is a testament to the reality that Republicans get sick, Democrats get sick, families need access to health care, Republican and Democratic business people need to be able to provide health benefits to their employees and can't do so, and it's hurting them and their communities. And Pennsylvania has been just such a shining light in terms of doing a lot with a little. There's not a lot of resources in terms of raw dollar amounts to spend on the movement in Pennsylvania, but boy, do you have the people power in terms of mm-hmm. the dedicated people working on the issue, and you're among them Chuck and David Stile and you know, Jerry Polakoff and you, and you know, I can think there's so many people, Sandy Fox and the coalition mm-hmm. on the western side of the state who work so mm-hmm. so hard, and Jim Furlow, and you know, just I can
yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
Go on and leave so many people out who are good, loving people towards one another in their communities who may disagree on some of the finer points on how to get there, but who, if given the chance, will move Pennsylvania forward in a very decisive way. And it's pretty exciting stuff in Pennsylvania. You're an amazing state.
Yes, and I think we ought to capitalize on this Occupy encampment here in Lancaster. But I was going to ask you also, in Vermont, do you see a lot of Republicans working for single payer there?
No, not in the same kinds of ways. But the interesting thing in Vermont is people think that they, you know, they, and you probably know, and a lot of the folks in the know and your audience probably know, that they didn't really pass yet a single payer bill as such. They passed kind of a roadmap to get there, which is an incredible accomplishment. But they have a governor who's been very openly in support of single payer, but they're also quick to point out, the people are quick to point out there, that the governor is supportive of that because their people are supportive of that and have been clear in their in that it isn't the politicians who define what the agenda will be or define next steps for Vermont. It's the people of Vermont. It's Vermonters who decide that.
Well, that's a good point. I think that if enough people rise up again and in great numbers to fight for whatever it is that they think is needed, then we'll see the change that needs to happen.
It's, of course, and that can be true for all of us. And nothing says it's going to be easy. It isn't easy, and this fight is not an easy one. The interest, as you all know, because God bless you, you produce Wendell Potter for us too, which is terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he
mm-hmm.
will talk very openly now about the experiences he had working for Cigna and for the insurance clients who define so much of what the agenda will be in healthcare in this country. But fortunately, we get through his eyes a glimpse into what we all said was true but didn't have the confirmation was true until Wendell was courageous enough to kind of get out there and put his career and his life really on the line, tell the truth. So if we keep speaking that truth to each other, however painful it may be as we go through this process, I can't believe we won't come out on the other end in a much better spot with health care and with our society in general.
Yes, I think so. I think we all have to go forth with, you know, good cheer. You know, it's not, it's all in the way that we approach it. And where if we have the goodwill and the cheer to, it affects people. People like to be, like good humor, and they don't like a lot of hateful stuff in their environment, no matter who they are. People don't like it. That was why Sarah Palin wasn't elected to begin with, is because she was so hateful. And when people start getting hateful, people don't want anything to do with it. So that's a good sign.
That is a good sign. You know, no matter how much you say you love God, if you don't like the people God created, it doesn't go over well.
That's a good point. That's right. I mean,
about that.
Yeah. I say that, I remember the old story that Ram Dass had during the Nixon administration. He would put his favorite saints up on his altar, and he'd pray to every saint, and then he'd have Richard Nixon there, and he'd have to be as loving towards Richard Nixon as he was to all of his gurus. I thought that was
now that is really loving the world, I'm telling you.
I think that's where we have to go. Well, now we have come to the end of this program. This has been a delightful hour, and I appreciate your coming on. So,
okay,
I loved it.
Thank you for everything you do in the world. You put out the energy that you hope to create, and that's wonderful.
I also forgot to ask you that you need to get your articles together and create a book.
That is such a good point. I am actually finally putting that book together. It's in the editing process right now, so thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, my gosh. What's the name of your book?
Well, I fluctuate between Dignity Heals and calling it something else, although I'm kind of, I don't know. I have a chapter entitled Dignity Heals right at the moment, so we'll see if that holds to be just a chapter or it ends up being a book.
Well, listen,
more hard-hitting, but we'll see.
Yeah, when I'm into, I would love to read that book, and then we can get you on and promote it. That'd be great.
That sounds wonderful. I'd love that. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to be playing the song, or the music for Mother and Child, which I tried to play before the show, but it didn't take. And that's by Klaus D. Jensen, who has created this music for preterm labor patients to help save the babies. So that's the story behind this music. Donna, thank you again, and I look forward to talking with you again, especially about your book. So thank you.
Thank you, Kate, so much. Good night.
Good night.